Welcome to the Newsbusters podcast with your host, executive editor of Newsbusters, Tim Graham.
Hello and welcome. There's a chill in the air in Northern Virginia. It's almost October, so it's time to pour a little pumpkin spice in your Newsbusters podcast. My latest nationally syndicated column is about Politico and Hunter Biden. You know, there's a new book out now on the Bidens. That's the title, The Bidens, by a Politico reporter. So now Politico can report to the world that the emails on the Hunter Biden laptop are real. Isn't that something? Isn't that special? Isn't it funny the way the liberal media suddenly decides, oh no, we said they were fake last year, now they're not. This book compares the Bidens to the Kennedys, like that's a good thing. It claims they're both Irish Catholic clans. Yeah, at this point, the Catholic fact-checkers say pants on fire. And Dominus Vobiscum. Speaking of lapsed Catholic Democrat families, how about those Cuomos? CNN's so-called journalistic ethics keep taking a beating, or a squeezing. On Friday morning at 5 in the morning, the New York Times posted a guest essay by longtime TV news executive Shelley Ross with this headline, Chris Cuomo sexually harassed me. I hope he'll use his power to make change. Excuse me, don't they at CNN try every night to make change? Wouldn't this have packed a bigger wallop a few weeks ago, right around his brother's resignation as governor, or even before that? I mean, Ross makes it clear she doesn't really want Cuomo to be fired. She wants Cuomo to make up for it with a bunch of, you know, Me Too TV specials about the continuing education of Chris Cuomo. She said she'd had enough after all this stories about how Chris had advised his brother Andrew about how to fight the charges of sexual harassment. And then there was Mr. Cuomo in the Hamptons after the resignation, appearing in a photo wearing a T-shirt emblazoned with the word truth. Yeah, that was too much. So apparently, in 2005, she said she was the executive producer at ABC. Before that, she'd been executive producer at Primetime Live, where Chris was underneath her on the chain. She was at this party with her husband, who sat behind her. Cuomo came into this party at an Upper West Side bar in New York. He walked toward me and greeted me with a strong bear hug while lowering one hand to firmly grab and squeeze the cheek of my buttock. I can do this now that you're no longer my boss, he said to me with a kind of cocky arrogance. No, you can't, I said, pushing him off me at the chest while stepping back, revealing my husband, who had seen the entire episode at close range. We quickly left. Soon after, she received an email from Chris Cuomo about him being ashamed. Well, this is the best part. She kept the email, and there it is in the New York Times. From Cuomo Chris to Ross Shelley, Wednesday, June 1. Subject, now that I think of it, I am ashamed. Though my hearty greeting was a function of being glad to see you. Now, how many of us think that squeezing your boss on the butt is a hearty greeting? I was just glad to see you. What is it about groping men when they make these terrible excuses that they know sound incredibly lame? And then he says, so pass along my apology to your very good and noble husband. And I apologize to you as well for even putting you in such a position. Isn't it interesting that he apologized to the husband before her? Sometimes you have to wonder, why did he send this email? Obviously, to some extent, it's because he knew Shelley Ross still had influence in the industry. But isn't it also possible that Mrs. Chris Cuomo, Christina Cuomo, sort of suggested, I mean, was she present? Did she witness this? Did she not witness this? But it's quite possible she should have, might have said, you need to apologize. Well, there you have it, the evidence. You can't deny it when you sent an email saying, I'm sorry. The New York Times included a new response in this guest essay. Asked for comment, Mr. Cuomo said on Thursday night, as Shelley acknowledges, our interaction was not sexual in nature. It happened 16 years ago in a public setting when she was a top executive at ABC. I apologized to her then, and I meant it. Nick Fondacaro saw the piece we had up at Newsbusters and said, hey, did you remember the New York Post had this story in 2020? And it was Chris Cuomo on tape telling Michael Cohen that people were spreading around phony stories about his time at ABC, that he was sexually harassing somebody at ABC.
You know, I'm always careful when I talk to media, you know?
Right.
Do you know how many phone calls I've gotten from people at ABC who say that reporters are calling and lying about things they heard about me to try to get stories about me when I was at ABC? Guys calling and saying, I heard he was the Charlie Rose of ABC, used to invite women to the hotel and open his bathroom. Do I look like the kind of guy who's got to do that?
Sure, why not?
But you're saying, so lying, so I already now have a good source that says that he forced one woman to have sex. I just want to know if you've ever heard anything like that. There is no woman.
Right.
There is none of that.
So here's the problem.
Women who do work there saying, oh, yeah, you know, some of these men, and naming me with other guys, you know, we bumped into each other once in the elevator, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he made me really uncomfortable. I mean, what the f***?
It's a problem. And now you...
So I'm careful with the media always.
Right.
I've always told you, the media is not your friend.
No.
You notice how they always deny it until there's like tapes or an email? This is exactly what Chris Cuomo was trying to tell his brother Andrew. How are they going to prove that it ever happened? Deny, deny, deny. Fight, fight, fight. The truth doesn't matter, no matter if you wear a t-shirt that says truth. Now, I'd suggest that Chris Cuomo maybe should spend some time down at the church. There are Catholic parishes in the Hamptons. I checked on the Google. He might want to head in there. And as Tom Lehrer's song had it, you take the processional into the confessional, where the guy who's got religion will tell you if your sin's original. It's not original, right? This is Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer and the whole nine yards. The whole crew at 60 Minutes at the Christmas party. These are liberals. You know, it's one thing to go after Roger Ailes and Fox News. You know, they made a whole movie about that, Bombshell, where they had created a fake character, a fake hottie played by Margot Robbie, so that they could expose Roger Ailes. And then they had him played by John Lithgow, who's like, doesn't look like Roger Ailes at all. It's really not a good movie. But we can always say, yes, there's not going to be any Matt Lauer Lifetime movie. There's not going to be a Charlie Rose movie. And there's not going to be a Chris Cuomo movie. There's only a Fox News bashing movie. By the way, have you been to the MRC store? Shop.mrc.org has a t-shirt that says, Defund Socialism. Can you imagine trying to wear that on campus today and have them think, wow, you really want to be canceled? Joining us now in the Newsbusters podcast is Mike Gonzalez, a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and the author of the new book, BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks a lot for having me on. It's my pleasure to be on with you.
So give us an overview of what you have in this book. I don't think we've ever had a group like this, like Black Lives Matter, whose name is also a slogan, you know, a bumper sticker, a phrase.
Right. And that is, let me start with that, actually, because that's a very important point. Because you have to break down Black Lives Matter, right? First, you have the concept, which is unimpeachable. You know, Black Lives Matter greatly to me. And I don't even have to say that all lives matter. You know, obviously all lives do matter, but, you know, Black Americans have suffered exceptionally, as we all know. We don't have to even, you know, go through that history. Everyone understands it. So Black Lives Matter to me. Then you have, so you have the concept, and then you have a movement. People say, well, there's the BLM movement. And I struggle with what a movement is. I guess if you mean people who march and go to demonstrations, or people who put up, you know, pitch signs on their lawns. And I guess that's, a lot of that is virtue signaling, which is cynical. You know, I went to Brown, and I have a job in a bank, but I want to signal to everyone else that I believe in all the right causes. And a lot of that is just a manipulation of people's feelings, including a manipulation of the reaction to that awful video of George Floyd's killing, which was harrowing. And then you have the organizations and their founders and leaders. And that is really what the book is about. My book is about the leaders. They're Marxists. They, you know, there's no, they were recruited by communists. In one case, very early on, you know, Eric Mann boasts of having recruited Patrice Cullors when she was 17. He writes about, he uses the word recruit in his book, Playbook for Progressives. He's a former member of the Weather Underground, and he seeks world revolution. So Alicia Garza also, worked for a communist organization, a Marxist organization. And what they want to do is dismantle the organizing principle of society. So in other words, the goals are large. And that's, again, I'm quoting Alicia Garza and saying that. And they're very powerful. You know, they have millions of dollars in the bank. They have a bill in Congress. They have a curriculum which is being sent around the country. We have 14,000 school districts in the country, and they're making sure every student gets the BLM curriculum. They have so that's what my book is about. It's like, you know, before we stop and we change all of society, and we allow people to pull out the foundations of society and replace it with something else, let's take a look at who these people are who are calling for this and what they're doing.
Yeah, you know, this reminds me, back in May, the last time I wrote about Mike Gonzalez, there was an article or a story on NPR by their reporter Cheryl Corley. I think she's in Chicago. And bizarrely, she let Patrice suggest, well, she does believe in Marxism, but she laughs at the online comments that she's pushing a communist agenda. And then she says, I'm working on making sure that people don't suffer. I'm working to make sure people don't go hungry. As if I'm not for communism, I'm for feeding people. I mean, it's really disingenuous. And she plays clips of her on this video, but she leaves out the part where she says, I am a Marxist. But the best part of this story that was amazing when I was listening to it was, you were actually in it. And I'm like, how did this happen? Mike Gonzalez, I know, has been as critical of NPR and PBS as we have been at the MRC. And that, there you were.
Yeah, you know, I must say that Cheryl was fair to me. She was objective when it came to handling me. In that video that you're talking about, an interesting thing is that I think to me the most interesting aspect of that video is not just that Patrice Cullors, we're talking about a video, a February 2021 video. And Patrice Cullors admits once again, because the journalists refuse to write this, that she is a Marxist, but she admits something else. She says she's ambivalent about the term communism because communism has such a bad reputation. She calls it a bad rap. So she doesn't know about whether to use it in public. So in other words, she is admitting that she is a communist. By the way, Marxism and communism are synonyms to begin with. It was Marx, after all, who penned the Communist Manifesto along with Friedrich Engels in 1848. So for those in the back seats, communism and Marxism are synonyms. But Patrice Cullors herself says, you know, I don't use the word communist because it has a bad reputation.
Well, this reminds me of college. I think it reminds a lot of people at college where people would say to you, yeah, real communism hasn't been tried. You know, Marxism, the idea of it, it's just so wonderful about equality. And it's like, no, it says dictatorship or the proletariat. How about the D word?
Yeah, you know, this is, I think the principle itself of communism is horrible. This idea that we're all going to be equal in the end, no matter how hard we try or we strive. I'm sorry. No, I like ambitious people. I think this country was made by ambitious people. The person who comes to his office and turns on the light, and she's the last one to leave. She turns out the light. She is going to be rewarded, and she should be rewarded. And that is really what we have, a system that allows for that, that allows you to work hard in find material rewards in capitalism, and be able to then have a private life and a spiritual life. So I think that communism, to begin with, in principle, is horrible. And then in the practice, it's completely horrible. You know, communism is perfect only in that it has a perfect record of failure. It has produced not bread, but breadlines. And it suppresses the individual. It represses the individual. It ends in gulag. It's incredibly narcissistic for us Americans to think, you know, we're going to get it right here. It's like Senator Kaine of Virginia, who took to the floor of the Senate last year and said, "We invented slavery." No, for heaven's sakes, that is, you know, we by no means invented slavery, nor are we going to be the ones who perfect communism. We cannot be that narcissistic.
Well, speaking of narcissism, you know, the story that I also found interesting this spring was the Marxist millionaire real estate speculator. As the New York Post reported, protests broke out across the country in the name of Black Lives Matter. The group's co-founder went on a real estate buying binge, snagging four high-end homes for $3.2 million in the U.S. alone, according to property records. Patrice also eyed property in the Bahamas at an ultra-exclusive resort where Justin Timberlake and Tiger Woods both have homes. And then, of course, she got the $1.4 million place in the Topanga Canyon there in L.A. And they didn't want to do this story. There's one way this story got done. At least two fact-checkers, USA Today and Snopes, jumped in to defend her and basically suggest that this wasn't somehow ill-gotten gains.
You know, my response to this is that is a very classic approach by a communist. You know, Brezhnev and Andropov and Stalin and the rest also had their countryside dachas back in the day. And I don't even see a dichotomy here in Alicia in Patrice Couture's owning homes. And that, to me, that's not really the main part of the story, although, of course, it shows that you know, they're not helping Black Americans improve their lives. To me, the reason I wrote the book, I wouldn't have written, you know, we have con artists in America. I don't think there is a subject worth writing a book about. To me, it's the danger they pose to American society of overturning our society. We live in a BLM America right now. In many ways, we see the rise of critical race theory, which has entered all aspects of our lives. That is the direct result of 2020. And I guess we're just about to see the FBI's new uniform crime report, which makes it official now. What we all knew, that we had a horrendous spike in the crime and in the murder rate in America in 2020. The debate was whether it was 25% or 35%. And according to the FBI, it's right in the middle. Is 30%, surpassing the last spike by a lot. The last spike was 1968, another politically charged year with a lot of riots, and we had a murder spike that was 12%. This one completely stomps on that record, 30%. So we live in a BLM world right now.
Well, this is Mike Gonzalez, the media critic. You tweeted, "The New York Times managed to write a story on how 2020 experienced the biggest spike in homicides ever without once mentioning Black Lives Matter or defund the police." Although I must say the story tried, as they often do, they try to sort of gild around the lily or whatever. They cited many possible contributing factors, including various pandemic stresses, increased distrust between the police and the public after the murder of George Floyd, including a pullback by the police in response to criticism, and increased firearm carrying.
Right. in that the idea of the pandemic, which The Atlantic is also discussing, Peter Moskos, a criminologist, writing in The Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago, said COVID struck hard in Baltimore and Newark, and the murder rate in those cities didn't increase. And there was economic anxiety in other places like Anchorage, and the murder rate didn't increase. And indeed, there was COVID all over the world. You know, people experienced this lockdown and had to stay at home and lost their jobs all over the world. And they didn't have a spike in the murder rate. Only we did. And only we had a complete overhaul of society, a complete, destabilization because of riots and demonstrations and marches.
Well, and I suppose what the liberals will try to do now is say, well, there was a spike in murders under Trump. So don't blame the Democrats wanting to defund the police. Somehow this happened under Trump, and the country's all gone unglued because Trump is unhinged. I mean, that wasn't in the story, but...
I guess it will be the Second Amendment and Trump, although I'm old enough to remember that Trump offered help to the different mayors and different governors, and a lot of mayors and governors in blue cities and states said, no, thank you. We can handle ourselves here. Obviously, what we saw in Portland, no, they couldn't handle themselves.
Now, the Heritage Foundation tried to purchase an ad for your book on BLM, and then they noted Amazon's the nation's largest retailer blocked it from its website. And then, of course, when they were asked about this, Amazon notified Heritage that the book no longer complies with our current creative acceptance policies. I love that terminology because, creative means we'll leave Mein Kampf on for sale. Now, I know they backed down, but doesn't this kind of say something about how big tech and in Amazon's case, just big store?
Yeah, I mean, they're selling BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. The book is selling super well, by the way. It's a bestseller in several important categories, including Black and African-American history, where I take pride in the fact that it outsells Nicole Hannah-Jones and Ibram X. Kendi. But you're quite right. They came back to us and said, no, we banned the sale of the ads because the book deals with issues that are highly debated. And we just really did a double take on that and said, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? So, I mean, social issues are highly debated. And we need that. Actually, society needs that. Democracy needs debate. And we need to talk to each other and say, well, look at this set of statistics and have our opponents say, yeah, but don't overlook this set of statistics. And that is really what produces good outcomes. And to their credit, they did, after we came back and said, this is just unbelievable. They did reverse themselves. Amazon did. They did say, we're going to allow BLM to sell ads. And they said it was human error. To their credit, they could have said it was an algorithm. But they said it was human error. And they said they were trying to correct it through training. So in other words, what I get from that, and I may be wrong, what I get from that is somebody didn't like my book. Somebody didn't like the content of the book. And he or she decided to take it upon themselves to censor the ads. And you're right that when big tech has monopoly status or near monopoly power, they censor somebody, they really quash the right, the freedom of speech of that individual. I'm all for, look, I'm an extremist when it comes to property rights. I strongly believe in property rights and private property rights, and I understand these are private companies. But the erosion, there's a tension always between rights. And in this case, it's a tension between the property rights of these tech giants and the freedom of speech rights of the individual. And I think the erosion in property rights, if we say to these companies, you cannot discriminate according to political views, the erosion in their property rights will be very small when compared to the complete squashing, suppression of property rights when you're no longer allowed to express yourself on Facebook or Twitter or Google or Amazon, et cetera.
Well, and this is why, you know, we here at the MRC have a Free Speech America project. And it is, there is a tension there between private property rights and free expression. And on some level, part of it then is to use our democratic debate to say a bookseller, the nation's leading bookseller, should be the last people who ever try to say, well, I'm sorry, there's too much debate in this book. I mean, that's embarrassing. And they should absolutely back down on something like that. Let me just wrap with this. We were mentioning before we came on that you've been doing some traveling around the country talking about critical race theory. Obviously, people have had issues with this in their schools, and especially the parents of white children who have to worry that their white children are going to be told that they are, you know, they bear the original sin of the country and they are racist by the mere function of being white. Is that the kind of concern you're hearing, or is it much broader than that?
Well, you know, so again, you're right. I've been traveling. I think I've traveled now to 15 cities in the last 2.5 months, and I'm going to travel to another 19 cities through Thanksgiving. And I'm getting, I just got 200 people turned out in Mishawaka at the Holiday Inn. So, and this is astonishing, really. And it's people who are concerned about critical race theory entering their lives. And you're quite right that to say this to a young black girl, to a young white girl, that she is an oppressor is a form of child abuse. But I'll tell you what else is child abuse, is to tell a black child that to like to read or write is a white thing.
Yeah.
And literacy is a white thing, and that a punctuality is a white thing. That is disgusting and false. To read or write or to reason is a human thing. It's what separates us humans from the beasts. And it's just so wrong to say to a black child, you'll never amount, you'll never achieve equality in America, which is what Derrick Bell said, the godfather of critical race theory. So to me, what critical race theory does and says to black people about themselves is disgusting. And by the way, these things are against the law. We have the Civil Rights Act. We have Title VI, Title VII. You cannot discriminate against people according to their race or ethnicity or national background. In the case of Title VII, there's sex as well. And I think it's about time we start enforcing the law.
All right. Joining us has been Mike Gonzalez. He's a senior fellow at Heritage and has a new book out called BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. They are actually allowing it to be sold at Amazon now. And anywhere else you might pick up some books. Thank you for joining us, Mike.
It was entirely my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on. I'm a huge fan of your work, and I'm a huge fan of MRC.
I appreciate it. That's why we come to Newsbusters, to hear the other side of the story. So join us once, twice, 24 times a day, and thanks for joining us today.